Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Welcome to Beyond the Matrix with Rod Bryant and Jerry Gordon here on Israel News Talk Radio. Unplug, strap yourself in, because you are about to move beyond the Matrix.
It is a great day to be alive, Jerry, and to be on The Matrix. We have a great show lined up for our listeners. We have, as a repeat guest, Dilemman Abdul-Kadir, and he is a fantastic guy, a real mensch, a guy that's been working on behalf of the Kurds in Syria. He just spent a couple of days in D.C. with congressmen and senators and politicians alike to try to assuage them to be favorable about rulings for the Kurdish people. Jerry, why don't we take a little bit and you give us a bio of Dilemman for us.
Well, Dilemman is a relatively articulate spokesman for the Syrian Kurdish cause. He was born in Kirkuk. He and his family escaped. And the biggest irony is they ended up in the very same UN High Commissioner for Refugee camp in Syria called Al-Hol, in which a lot of the retreating civilians and, unfortunately, ISIS fighters among them have been holed up in this current conflict now in its final stages. But he is essentially the head of the Kurdistan Project for the Endowment for Middle East Truth in Washington, D.C., headed by a very good friend, Sarah Stern.
And we know that the work they're doing has had some effect. You and I have been talking about this subject for well over 2 years now and beating the drum of, you know, keep an eye on the Kurds and see what's going on, make sure you provide protection, etc. And for the longest time, we were sort of the lone voice out in the wilderness talking about it. But now we're seeing this become sort of mainstream conversation, not only in the media, but in Washington, D.C. So the reason why, Jerry, we wanted to bring Dilemman on is to actually update you, to help you understand what's going on the ground. What is the thought process within the halls of Congress? And also, what's the real reality with ISIS and what's going on with the battle? Has the caliphate been destroyed? Has ISIS been destroyed? Or are they still there, willing to put up a fight if they can? So we have a great show for you. Don't go away. You're listening to Beyond the Matrix here on Israel News Talk Radio, and we'll be right back.
Israel is located in one of the most volatile areas in the world. Israel is an island of stability in a sea of war and unrest. In the midst of this turmoil, Israel stands out as a beacon of order and human progress. Each week we update you on what's happening in this, the Jewish state, a true light unto the nations. This is Jay Shapiro. Join me every Thursday on Israel News Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Beyond the Matrix, here on Israel News Talk Radio.
And I'm Rod Bryant. Thank you so much for sticking around after the break here. We are, of course, with a guest that we brought on a couple of weeks ago, Dilemman Abdul-Kadir. And we're really excited to have him on the show because so many interesting things are taking place in Washington, D.C. Him meeting with several of the congressmen to talk about the Kurds. We wanted to bring him back on to give us the latest update. So we're going to go ahead and start and get right into the questions. Dilemman, thank you so much for taking time. I know you're busy, and I appreciate you taking time to let the audience know what work you're doing. Maybe before we start into the questions, could you tell us what you've been up to in the last couple of weeks?
Definitely. First of all, thank you for having me on again. This, as you guys both know, this is a very important and hot topic that's going on and around Capitol Hill and Washington, D.C. So the latest, I would say, is that we've had some hearings on the Hill. General Joseph Votel has testified before Congress, and we can discuss this in detail a little bit more, but the overall feeling and the mood is that we know for sure ISIS is not defeated, and there is a fear that there's a reemergence of ISIS that is able to come back. As you know, their numbers are high. The caliphate may be defeated, but their numbers are high in about 20 to 30,000 fighters. And the obviously, there's also the humanitarian crisis that continues to be a threat. And also, another topic is, are there enough forces to leave behind as the U.S. Gradually withdraws?
Yes. And so far, you feel that the reception has been good in Congress and in D.C.?
The reception in Congress has been good. I can say that for sure. They understand the threat coming out of Syria. Mm-hmm. They understand that if we don't fight them there, if we don't keep them down there, that the threat might come here and in Europe. This is understood. And I would say the administration is slowly understanding this as well. During the Munich Security Conference a few weeks back, a group of senators and lawmakers have sent the president a letter basically saying we need to stay in Syria.
Okay,
and the
good.
President just responded saying all is good, 100%. Everything is understood, and I agree with you. So this is a good response that
yeah,
we received.
That's got to make you feel pretty good that you have at least somebody listening to you now.
People are listening. You know, it's taking a while. People
right.
are listening, but there's a lot of more work to be done.
Okay. What is the Syrian Democratic Forces' understanding of the change in the position regarding withdrawal from Syria?
Right. So the SDF has always pushed for keeping troops in Syria, the entire 2,000 forces that we have. We have 200 in El Tanf in the southwest border, but we have 2,000 East Euphrates. They've been asking for all of the troops to stay. Now the president wants to now gradually withdraw them and keep 200 to 400 troops there. I believe the latest number is 400 troops. So the SDF do appreciate this, obviously, and an American presence is very symbolic in northeast Syria, largely because it keeps Iran away from the oil fields. It keeps the Assad legitimacy at mm-hmm. minimum. It keeps the Russians away, who are more than happy to fill in that vacuum. And the understanding throughout, you know, from the DOD, Congress, and the administration is that it will keep the Turks away from, and I quote, slaughtering the Kurds.
Right.
So this is very important. The Kurds appreciate the American stance currently at 400 troops, because even one American will keep the enemies at bay.
So basically these 400 are going to be working in an advisory position and maybe indirect combat roles, I guess.
Right. So the first position was actually that they will be peacekeepers. When it was first announced by the White House.
Right.
So the president said that Sarah Sanders actually said that it'll be their position will be peacekeepers predominantly. That's, however, changed to training and equipping and advising and also patrolling.
Okay.
So basically going back to similar to their previous role, instead of just being peacekeepers, just staying there at the border. And that peacekeeper role is going to be based in the northern border between the Syria and Turkey, and also along the Euphrates Valley between the Assad regime and the SDF.
I tell you, I'm really sold on that footprint, put it this way. I know that in Afghanistan, in the beginning of the war, two dozen special operators along with Afghan fighters was able to completely rout out the Taliban. So, you know, it can be done. It really can be done. And with a smaller footprint, tactical heavy. You can move around and get things done a lot quicker. It seems to be anyway. Jerry, did you want to jump in?
This past weekend, Ambassador John Bolton was interviewed, and he said he's apparently making progress in terms of building out the combined force with allies in the UK, France, and Germany. Although that's not quite there yet, Dillman, what do you think are still the issues of bringing about those folks on board for this combined force in Syria?
Right. These European allies haven't fully committed as of yet. And the intent of from the United States position is this was their attempt all along, is to bring in our European allies to do more of their part as well. So not fully a United States role and not the United States taking the lead on this. And from the Kurdish standpoint, I think this is understood. This makes sense. It's okay for that as long as you have a combination of about 2,000 forces. So the latest on that is that the French have already committed. However, I would say after the four American service members lost their lives back in December, President Macron stated that he would like to stay for more than a year, as long as they have the American airstrikes. And because, as we know, they don't have the tools or capabilities to do this alone. And the UK looks like they're on board, according to John Bolton. And also, I would add, there's a number of about 12 countries that will keep troops there, and that includes the Dutch, the Australians, and others. So I think there is a willing to stay there as long as the United States sets a clear plan to commit to Syria. Because, as you know, before they came in, the policy was we came in together, we will leave together, and the United States can't leave alone.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So you're saying the numbers of soldiers on the ground still are going to be around 4,000 to 6,000.
About 2,000.
Okay, about 2,000.
Yeah.
Okay.
So give or take about 2,000. I think that number would go back up. So it won't be 2,000 U.S. troops alone. It would be a combination of say 400 U.S. troops, few hundred French, U.K., and it would come about 2,000.
Right. Okay. Jerry, continue.
When you mentioned French President Macron coming to the plate after the four U.S. Individuals, two combat and two non-combat, and that raises the question about whether or not there is, in fact, an additional, quote, complement of contractors from various federal agencies here in the United States that would be there in above the 2,000 mark.
Right. So the conversation of contractors actually was had. This is more complicated. As you know, contractors don't have a great reputation, especially in since Iraq, the 2003 Iraqi War. However, this does make sense as well. This is very much realistic. I know they can fill in the gaps where the U.S. forces can't. This would please the president's demand. And it would also allow the Europeans to keep a less number of forces and less commitment inside of Syria altogether. So contractors wouldn't be a bad idea.
No, and look, the rules of engagement for contractors has at least become a little bit more restricted, especially those who are operating outside or inside from the United States. And look, they're doing a major contribution to protecting embassies, to you name it, already, and most people don't know that.
Exactly. And I think they can play a significant role in securing the oil fields. A lot of people don't know, actually, the oil fields in Syria, especially in northeast Syria, are also military bases. So this is very important, and that we have to secure these regions, because if we're not there, Russia will be there. If we're not there, Iran and Assad will be there.
Yeah, and most definitely Turkey would love to be there.
Oh, yeah. Turkey has no natural resources inside its country. Capturing these oil fields and regaining these territories would be a long grievance fulfilled since the downfall of the Ottoman Empire.
Well, speaking of Turkey, we know that Turkey's bent on controlling the so-called safe zone and liberating Kurdish northeastern Syria. What is the Syrian Democratic Council's position and the U.S. position on this issue?
So the SDF's position as far as a Turkish safe zone or Turkish buffer zone is absolutely a no as far as Turkish military forces coming into the sovereign territory of Syria, because we, the Kurds and the Americans, understand, I think, pretty well what Turkey's intent is, and that is to slaughter the Kurds.
Right.
It's to commit demographic change. It's to bring in Arab Syrian refugees into the indigenous population of where Kurds live, Kurdish villages, Kurdish cities. I think about seven or eight major Kurdish cities are along the Turkish border inside Syria. So all this would be taken down. All this basically would be the Kurdish flags or the Syrian flags would be removed and replaced by Turkish flags. Schools would be Islamified. So this is very dangerous. The United States is also against this because as the president announced his withdrawal, Turkey said he would, Erdogan said he would fill in this gap. But Turkey does not have the capabilities to control such a large region.
Excellent. I really appreciate the explanation on that because we're really getting some clarity that we haven't been able to get in a long time. You're listening to Beyond the Matrix here on Israel News Talk Radio. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after these few messages.
The Tamar Yonah Show.
Tamar, she's sassy.
She's smart.
She's funny.
But she's also a real Jewish mother.
Hi, everybody. I'm Tamar Yonah. And yes, I can be all of those things, but at Israel News Talk Radio, I'm here to bring you the news stories and guests that you may not hear anywhere else. Join me live on air Sundays, Mondays, and Tuesdays for the most unique and bold talk radio in Israel.
The Tamar Yonah Show.
Welcome back to Beyond the Matrix, here on Israel News Talk Radio.
And we are back already. I'm Rod Bryant, along with my amazing co-host, Jerry Gordon. And we have Diliman Abdulkader. And we are talking about Syria and to give an update with about the Kurds in Syria. And I don't know what question we left off. I think we're going to be talking about the weapons that are going to be put in the area.
That's correct.
Go ahead, Jerry.
Basically, the great leader in Turkey, Erdogan, had requested the U.S. to retrieve all the heavy weapons that the SDF had been provided by the U.S. So the question for you, Dilman, is what is the U.S. coalition position regarding SDF retention of such weapons and modernization of arms? And moreover, because of your recent congressional contact, what seems to be the sounds coming back from those encounters?
Right. So the U.S. position as far as collecting these weapons from the SDF or the Kurdish component of the SDF, the YPG and the Women's Protection Unit, the YPJ, to please Turkey is an absolute no. Largely because this is unrealistic. Let's be honest. No one has the capabilities to collect all these weapons. I mean, they're all over Northeast Syria. They're in the hands of the SDF, not only Kurds, but also the Arab components as well. And Erdogan is attempting to push this because he sees the Kurds as terrorists. And he fears that, okay, one day the Kurds will use this against the against Turkey and the Turks. We know this is not true. And also, as far as Congress's position, I believe they do want to make sure that the SDF is well-armed and well-equipped in order to fight this last phase of the caliphate, of whatever's left of ISIS.
Okay. One of the flashpoints between Turkey and the U.S. has been Kurdish-held Manbij. There have been now two suicide attacks there, one in January and this past week. What does that say about the resiliency of the ISIS sleeper cells to continue the conflict along the Euphrates River?
Right. This just proves that ISIS still exists. This proves that there are sleeper cells across Syria and Iraq. And also, they're a major threat. So we cannot continue to leave the area while there are a threat to the humanitarian crisis. They're a threat to the villages, to the resources, because this just proves that, you know, they can come back. They can create another caliphate. And we don't want that. That's not in the interest of the United States. That's not in the interest of not even Turkey, and not even in the interest of the Kurds, of course. So in Manbij, we have seen bombings, and the United States, I believe, just committed to staying in Manbij to continue the joint patrol along with the Turks, as was their position before.
Rod?
How complicated is this, is the final SDF assault on the last, actually the last holdout of Baghouj held by the ISIS fighters in eastern Syria?
Right. So the last battle in Baghouj, actually, I believe it began on Sunday. And this was announced by the SDF commander. Mm-hmm. The Baghouj is basically a tent encampment, a tent city. And as you know, ISIS's tactics is that they're using human shields. Mm-hmm. Thousands of civilians have left Baghouz into local refugee camps, and many are afraid that they will lose their lives. The SDF is coordinating this attack with the global coalition, with the U.S. Air power, mm-hmm. And they're doing it phase by phase, step by step. They are pausing as they continue the investments, largely because they're waiting for the civilians to come out. They're
right.
Allowing civilians because they don't want to harm these lives, innocent lives. And also, ISIS does have hostages as well. So they're they're trying to figure out ways to release these hostages while at the same time take down their
right.
last territorial hold.
You know, I can imagine this is a pretty sensitive subject for yourself, being a person as a child leaving Iraq to go live in a refugee camp. That's not a very pleasant world to live in, is it?
It's not, you know, and that same refugee camp, Al-Hol camp, many of these civilians are fleeing to Al-Hol camp in northeast Syria. So mm-hmm. I myself and my family understand very well what these people are going through.
Hmm.
The 10,000 estimated civilians and 2,000 ISIS fighters who fled Baghouz and surrendered to SDF troops, how much of a burden has that placed on the SDF and the U.S. troops for processing and detention of them in northeast Syria?
It's a heavy burden, largely because, first of all, you have to vet these refugees, because many of the ISIS terrorists are actually posing as refugees.
Mm-hmm.
They have their family members posing as refugees, which, you know, as we know, they were not refugees. Their children are caught up in this act between the wife and the husbands. So it's a heavy burden, and the SDF cannot do it alone. The U.S. troops cannot do it alone. That's why it's very important for the global coalition to continue this strategy of protecting not only the SDF, but the humanitarian crisis as well, against ISIS, because everybody is fleeing all at once. So there has to be coordination. There has to be organization in order to stop these civilians from, you know, there might be terrorists within these people.
Is the UN coordinating this?
The UN is coordinating with the Americans and the European allies, including the SDF, of course, and the major refugee camp is Al-Hol camp that's run by the United Nations, and they're taking in thousands. I believe since March 7th, 4,000 to 5,000 civilians have came into Al-Hol camp alone since March 7th, and since December, over 50,000.
Wow. So do you think that the commitment of the ISIS fighters who have given up is a serious thing? I mean, do you think this is the end, the beginning of the end for them?
I don't think it's the beginning or of the end. I think these ISIS fighters, if we're up to, they're doing it because they have no choice,
okay.
If I'm going to be honest.
Yeah.
If they could fight, they would still fight. If the caliphate still existed, they would fight for the caliphate. And I think there are many, as we've said earlier, thousands that are still fighting for the caliphate. Actually, there was a released audio coming from ISIS. It's supposed to be from Baghouz, where the battle is.
Mm-hmm.
And they're saying, you know, the Crusader warplanes and the Kurdish atheists are coming to attack our land. So this just shows that the ISIS is still exists. They still believe in this ideology,
right.
This radical ideology.
So this is the reason, and hence the reason, why it's important we keep up the pressure and keep a presence there in the region.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Pressure is very
not going to go away.
It's not alone. Yep. It's
right.
not going away anytime soon. And we can't rely on the central governments of these states to take up the burden as well, because we know how ISIS came about. It's the isolation of major populations, such as in Iraq, the Sunni population.
You know, as much as I would like to see our troops not in the land, in that area, because of the fact that my own children serve in the military, I realize this is the new norm in the world. And it's unfortunate, but it's the new norm. We have to almost face that reality.
Exactly. Unfortunately, thank you for your son's service as well. We really do appreciate that. Unfortunately, this is the new norm. But one positive thing I can say about Syria in particular is that there is a willing 60,000 force made up of majority Kurds, but also Arabs that want to do the fighting themselves and protect the land themselves.
Right.
But we just need the American support and advice.
Right. Jerry?
There are media reports that many of these foreign ISIS fighters and families may not be able to return to their countries of origin, despite requests to do so from President Trump. Could that possibly slow down the U.S. troop withdrawal scheduled to conduct diplomacy and develop alternative arrangements for processing and detention?
The remaining, those that want to return back to the Europe or back to the United States, I've seen some members of Congress say that we should send them to Guantanamo, for example. I know Tom Cotton suggested that through a tweet. Others say that we should hold them in trial. Others say that we should keep them in Syria. I think that the Kurds don't have the capabilities to keep them there, the SDF, unless they're going to get the aid they need, the help they need. But if we're going to keep them in Syria, if the United States and Americans and Europeans don't have the appetite to bring them back, which I think is reasonable, obviously, but we should help the Kurds solve this issue. We should give them what they need to keep them there. I think this just continues to prove the fact that we should delay the withdrawal. And the president is, I think, is finally realizing that ISIS still exists. There is a threat, and they're trying to come back to the U.S. too.
So, Dilliman, are you suggesting that it could be a problem resolved in keeping the ISIS fighters who have surrendered there in internment camps or whatever you want to call it? It could be done.
It could be done. The problem is it's very difficult to vet them. Because many are posing as I've said, as refugees.
Right,
so
right.
Many of the refugees, the actual refugees that are the people, the innocent civilians that are suffering, are being manipulated by these individuals as well. And it's hard to tell the difference.
My goodness.
So it puts the Americans and the SDF and the organizations such as, you know, the United Nations at a difficult position.
That seems to have been the problem, by the way, when the final stages of the conquest in Iraq by a combination of the Kurds and what passes for the Iraqi National Army, that the stream of those refugees were penetrated rather deeply by ISIS lay-behinds.
And
which raises a question.
We're going to be out of time. Won't you save that question to the next segment? Can you do that?
I can do that.
Excellent. Hold on to it if your memory can last that long. I'm Rod Bryant along with Jerry Gordon. You're listening to Beyond the Matrix here on Israel News Talk Radio.
In a time where feelings have become fact, where rational thought and common sense has disappeared, one man stands above it all.
I'm Howie Sobiker, your political hitman.
Political Hitman airs every Tuesday at 11:59 p.m. North American time, 7 a.m. Israeli time, only on Israel News Talk Radio.
Are you interested in transforming your life, drawing closer to the Creator, and uncovering the deeper meanings and hidden treasures in the Hebrew Bible?
Then join me, Rav Yitzhak Michelson.
And me, William Hall.
On The Science of Kabbalah, where we are seeking to narrow the gap between what we understand of our physical and spiritual worlds. So make sure to tune in every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Israel time, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, here on Israel News Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Beyond the Matrix, here on Israel News Talk Radio.
Thank you for sticking around after the break. I'm Rod Bryant along with Jerry Gordon, and we are talking about Syria with the representative come from Emet. His name is Dilliman Abdulkadir, and we've been talking about the update about the Kurds in Syria. Jerry, you had a question that you wanted to ask before the break. Why don't you go ahead and ask that now?
These surrendering ISIS fighters, who many of whom are in the stream of refugees, reminds us of a lot of activities in the conquest by the Peshmerga and what passes for the Iraqi National Army in the reestablishment, so to speak, of Mosul. There was a lot of problems of infiltration by these folks. Tillman, what complication does that have for the processing at this point in time?
Right. The biggest threat coming from this is that ISIS uses human shields. And with that said, is that we have to be careful that we don't harm these civilians, but also we have to be careful that we don't allow these terrorists to be to pretend they are they're suffering from a humanitarian crisis, because we know that they're the real enemy. So this is a huge complication: is how do you vet these people? How do you go from neighborhood to neighborhood, and making sure that you're capturing the right people, killing the right people, and that you're not harming civilians? And civilians are in the thousands and the thousands. And I don't think any country, let alone Iraq or the KRG, the Iraqi security forces, or the Peshmerga, have the ability to take care of all this.
There have been reports of ISIS fighters coming across the frontier into Iraq, engaging in ambushes against the Shiite popular mobilization units south of Mosul. Does that indicate resiliency of ISIS to reconstitute cadres and re-enter northeast Syria?
Right. So this reminds me of back in 2014 when the ISIS was coming about. We have to remember again that ISIS rose due to an isolation effect coming from the central government under Prime Minister Nouri Maliki. He basically gave all the power to the Shiites. The Sunnis were left isolated. They were they were not given government positions, military positions, and basically this will be we should expect this from now on as the caliphate is gone. Is that Sunni Shiite tension? I wouldn't call it a war, but a Sunni Shiite tension that could lead to another ISIS, ISIS 2.0 possibly, because the predominantly the Iraqi military is made up of Shiites, and as you know, the Shiite militias, the Popular Mobilization Forces, or the Hashd al-Sha'bi, are Shiites, and they're fully funded by Iran.
Wow. Now, interestingly enough, today I think is the second day of visits to Iraq by none other than Iranian President Rouhani, and there have also been pressure on the existing Iraqi regime to demand the withdrawal of those 5,500 plus U.S. forces at Al-Sad in western Iraq. What is Iran's intent there?
Right. As you know, Iran's intent is largely to control the Shiite population. It's about 60% of Iraq's population is Shiite, with 20% Sunni and 20% Kurds, Sunni Kurds. And Iraq is caught between a tug of war, where the Americans are want to continue to have a presence there. The president said to keep an eye on Iran. But as you know, we know what Iran has done in the region. This is not a secret. Iran's continued to expand throughout the Shiite region in the south. They have total control of the military. They have total control of the militias within the, and legal militias, if I may add, under the Iraqi constitutions, which Hashd al-Sha'bi is. And they have total control of civilian political life. And this is an attempt to institutionalize the Iraqi life, basically, with Iran's agenda, similar to what they have done successfully under Hezbollah in Lebanon.
So basically, he's attempting to make what already exists, as we would call in Jewish life, to make it kosher, to get some normalization out of the whole thing.
Right. And, you know, and my response to that is the Americans did liberate Iraq from Saddam Hussein. Mm-hmm. The Shiites were oppressed by Saddam Hussein. It was the Americans that sacrificed their lives. It was the 2003 war that liberated Iraq from the Ba'athist regime, which both the Shiites and the Kurds wanted. Mm-hmm. So now that the job is done, why are we threatening American soldiers on the ground? There's 5,500 troops there. My response is to, if the Iraqis don't want them there, the Kurds would like them there in the KRG.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, that would be really important. I cannot see that Assad would become something that is abandoned. I just cannot see that happening unless they are able to remobilize in a Kurdish area. Now, that would make sense. That would make complete sense. You know, we talked and opened up the show. We have about, 5 minutes left in the show. We talked about how you were up in Washington most of the day yesterday in Washington, D.C., talking to congressmen, senators, et cetera, et cetera. How strong is the bipartisan congressional support for a Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Force?
The SDF has a lot of support on the Hill. Those on the as far as lawmakers understand the SDF pretty well. What I would like to add to that is the next step. As the caliphate is defeated, we know there's ISIS terrorists still left, but the next step, I would say, is the recognition of the SDC, the Syrian Democratic Council. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm trying to educate lawmakers on, is to basically recognize this so we don't recognize Damascus. We know Assad's legitimacy stops at the Euphrates River, mm-hmm. And the SDC is a self-governing system that has been implemented since 2015, and it has worked, and it includes the minorities in the region. And the SDF has strong support as far as military relationship with the West and the global coalition. But I think we should start recognizing the Syrian Democratic Council so they can stand independently, so they can sell their oil legally and create a safe haven like we have like the Americans did for the Kurds in the KRG.
For our listening audience, could you explain the SDC, how they have been operating, the fact that they're a very pluralistic society, they're not sectarian in any way. Could you describe that so that people can know what we have there in that part of Syria and Iran?
Right, so definitely, yeah. The Syrian Democratic Council governs northeast Syria. It is composed of not only Kurds, but Arabs.
Hi there.
It's composed of Assyrians, it's composed of Syriacs, it's composed of Yazidis and minorities. So it is a representative of the indigenous Syrian population, not only Kurds. Turkey would like to, you know, say that this is a Kurdish project, but it's not. And also they have equal representation for both men and women. This is unheard of in the Middle East, you know, aside, as you can say, from Israel. But as far as the rest of the region, the SDC works, has worked. They've had elections. They've had numerous elections, actually, and they continue to do so. And that's why it's important for the SDF, the military aspect of this project, to continue to have the tools they need to in order to secure this region.
So you would say the biggest argument for the SDC, the council, you call it council, right?
Right, Syrian Democratic Council.
The Syrian Democratic Council, the best argument for the preservation is that they have a track record. They've been doing this without too many problems, and they know how to work together in a bipartisan way.
Exactly. It has worked and it will continue to work as long as they are protected from the air. That's mm-hmm. the biggest threat, because, as you know, they don't have a air force. And that's why we need the global coalition to continue to support the SDF.
Jerry, we have 3 minutes. You have something you want to throw in?
Yeah, I do. If this area in northeast Syria is going to survive with some degree of autonomy, would it ever be renamed Kurdistan Rojava?
I wouldn't be opposed to that. However, the SDC has worked because it is not Rojava. It's because it is a combination of including of all the indigenous population. The Arab population of the northeast Syria would not like that. I think the other minorities would not like that, because then it would be a Kurdish project, and Turkey, it would give more ammunition to Turkey to say, see, this was we told you so all along. This was the intent of the Kurds, and I think this would allow Turkey to move in from the north, because, as you know, Turkey fears another autonomous region for the Kurds. Mm-hmm. So as long as they have a self-administering government, I think and a border shared with the KRG. I think for now, this is the best step.
Excellent. Could you give us a website so that our listeners can go and stay up to date on what's going on in the region?
Actually, you can follow my Twitter account, D_Abdulkader. I tweet frequently on there and give updates on both my issues on the Hill and also what goes on the ground.
Excellent. The last thing that I'd like to ask, we have about a minute left. Israel obviously has in some way provided some support, if anything, moral support. But how detrimental do you think that it is when it comes to Turkey sort of attaching Israel and the United States to the Kurds to say this is an Israeli-American project and these atheists and these hordes of horrible people need to be stamped out of Syria?
Right. With the Israeli subject, as far as tying them to the Kurds, it's always has been a double-edged sword. It was during the referendum. The Shiites came out and spoke against it. Maliki spoke against it, said that we don't want a second Israel in Iraq, and we will not allow that. And the same thing in Syria. And the Kurds have to be realistic because their neighbors are Assad and Turkey and the Iraqis.
Excellent, man. Really appreciate you coming on. Hopefully we'll be able to chat with you real soon. Again, you've been listening to Beyond the Matrix here on Israel News Talk Radio. We'll see you next week. Shalom, shalom.
Where can you get the inside news on Israel? At Israel News Talk Radio, we're dedicated to sharing Israel's inside story with the world by providing our listeners with news on Israeli politics, current affairs, and Israeli Jewish culture. The Israel News Talk Radio homepage also provides you, the listener, with useful information at your fingertips, with scrolling news headlines, weather, currency exchange, Shabbat candle lighting times, and so much more. Our radio programming is always accessible and on demand. We operate absolutely free of charge for everyone, everywhere. If you love what we do, partner with us now by becoming an Israel News Talk Radio supporter. With your support, you'll be inscribed on our Israel News Talk Radio Wall of Fame. There's nothing like us in the world. Be part of something great. Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
Howdy, this is Rita from League City, Texas, now living in Israel. And though my heart may have belonged to Texas, it now belongs to Israel and all the fantastic show hosts at Israel News Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Michael Solomon from Kiryat Arba, Israel. And why do I love listening to Israel News Talk Radio? Because I love listening to the interesting interviews they do and their news reporting that most other media sources don't cover.
Hey, this is Nicole Eko from Malmo, Sweden. It gets pretty cold here in Sweden, so I love cuddling up with a warm cup of tea while I listen to Israel News Talk Radio.
Hey, everybody, this is Frank Karras from Tennessee. Me and my dog Buster really love listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
News, opinion, and more. You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.